He went to get some.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we'll stand at ease for a moment.
Because that would be subject to lawsuit. Mr. Chairman, can I raise a point?
Sure, you bet.
On the bottom of 57, Prop 58, getting back to this ordinance, they're reinforcing themselves on. You might understand that an outside area, outside the city, can veto that ordinance. It overwhelmingly carries within. Do we want to do that? In effect, you're given my suggestion would be to do the same thing. Let the total majority vote carry the ordinance.
We're great.
Both inside and out.
We're dual majority men.
I mean, if you're intentionally going to be a veto power, this ordinance, report the ordinance to the area outside the cities and the areas inside. I don't know. I think that's too good.
Well, if you'll go for unification on the same basis.
You mean a total vote?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, Mike, I think you're getting to an area now where you're going to start upsetting what I thought we intentionally agreed upon. I think that one of the features that makes this more palatable, because normally borough assemblies would be the last legislative body to reapportion themselves, but I think this apparatus keeps them more honest.
I think we change that ordinance.
Yeah, I want it subject to veto. That's right.
By a minority group?
Possibly, yes.
Okay, now I have one more question. When you, the same thing that Jess raised a second ago, when we used the word general election in there, now is that referring to the November election?
Mr. Chairman, I have to state on this that when 29-23-040 was redrafted to eliminate this requirement that city councilmen be appointed to the assembly, which was the mandatory requirement in the code, I took the sections as they appear in the main bill, CSSB 113, and I glanced at the technical amendments that had been made in the supplements that came out as a result of committee substitutes, and perhaps erroneously missed the amendments which had been made in CSHB 208, and added a lot of technical amendments to the code to drop the general election and substitute on the first Tuesday of October as the time of the election. So if that's a technical goof, which I'll have to re-examine, and I'm glad it was caught here, and I'll make the correction. But it's definitely the committee's intent, I think, to restore that October election date, unless provided otherwise by ordinance. That would be
reluctantly one member of the committee went along with
it. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say that on your meeting on March 21st, you said notwithstanding the other provisions of the act, remaining municipality may by ordinance adopt a date other than the first Monday, Tuesday of October.
Yes.
But we're very specific, put it October, and if they want to have it in November, they can do that.
Yeah.
We certainly want that.
Right. A lot of these technical amendments were tacked on there. I don't recall they being adopted in the Senate specifically as part of the report. Somehow somebody added to the bill technical amendments to be made by legislative affairs.
Yeah.
I had prepared the amendments a long time ago.
But they adopted them, and then we, at our first meeting, also.
All right, well, that would be sufficient. The fact that the conference committee wants all these amendments in there, and I'm just afraid I slipped in making the transposition.
Well,
I'm glad it was brought to our attention.
No problem. Okay, let's bring up another amendment then, and I think you probably would. Move on these. I think on pages 61, 62, and then I'm going to hear from Mr. Morehouse. 61, 62, we've got some additional amendments that possibly already for adoption. Everybody got those pages?
What page?
There's 61 in the front of your book.
Needed some further amendments.
Yeah,
the committee wanted to prepare.
Yeah. The first one, page 110 in the charter, code, line 28, delete two propositions and substitute propositions. I suppose that's the technical.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that raises a policy question which I had to make an assumption about. As you know, when you have a unification election now, there are two questions asked on the ballot. One, shall the borough of all cities unite to form a unified government? And two, knowing that the powers of the unified government would be essentially the same whether it's called a city or a borough, should, is the preference to call it a city, a borough, or something else that the Charter Commission may designate? Now, I eliminated that question. Do you want that proposition to be retained on the ballot?
The Charter Commission isn't paying attention to it anyway, so forget it.
Yeah.
I assume that the committee does not want it continued.
Do you want to make a motion to that effect?
I so move.
First of all, the amendment you asked, what amendment was presented last week?
No.
The one you drew up. Mr. Chairman, that was presented. The one you drew up with, or you asked for, which stated in effect, the question should be, shall there be unification? And it in effect required unification, and then
required a vote on.
Yes, vote on unification, excuse me. And then the question would be simply the approval of a charter eventually, as was required in the provision also. Now, the committee decided to defer that amendment, which is in your book here.
What page is that amendment?
Sandy, do you have
61.
No, that's today's. This is the other amendment on the same subject that the committee wanted prepared for tonight.
On 42, I think, isn't it? Is that it?
Yes. That's right. This was the proposal discussed last week and decided to be held until Senator Murray's return. And that was whether the borough and all cities should unite to form a single unit of home rule government. And then it provided further that if they do, if unification is approved, the Charter Commission would function until an acceptable charter is prepared and ratified by the voters. The question on the ballot now, under existing laws, shall the borough and all cities unite into a single unit of home rule government after the election of a charter commission by the voters and the adoption of recommendations of the charter commission by a majority vote from the area outside cities and all cities? So there is a substantial difference in the thrust of the proposition. Now, the committee asked that an amendment prepared, which is the one you have to be prepared, which is the one you have on page 61, which would simply kind of reverse the emphasis and ask whether the Charter Commission should be formed to prepare, adopt, and submit to the voters a proposed charter which would provide for unification. I added in there, in the parentheses, you'll note in the question, and a Charter Commission member, and Charter Commission member to be elected is elsewhere provided on the ballot, because the way the law is now written, they put up both questions. The election on the question and the choice of the Charter Commission. You may want to strike that, however. I just thought it would be helpful for the voter, but then when I read the question, I wasn't so sure. I hope the committee will consider it. The language in parentheses you may want to strike.
What we have here, in a sense, two different concepts. The amendment as I read it, would require that in the next election after the passage of this act, every city and borough in the state would be required to vote on whether they wanted to unify or not.
It would appear on the ballot.
Yeah.
Right. They could accept it or reject it.
And then if they accepted it,
then it would be implemented by ordinance.
Yeah, right. And the charter commissions would continue to submit charters to the electorate until they finally came up with one that was acceptable.
Now, basically, I don't require a lot of this, really. Just it changes the inertia, it changes the momentum. And what it does has been unification. Remember the first unification here in Utah? I mean, they squabble over provisions of the ordinance that gets down into issues. And they do that principle of unification. And I suggested to Greg that maybe even this amendment I asked him to draft include another provision which will say that the charter itself can be provided to the people in sections. It doesn't have to be provided as one charter unit. For example, the Board of Trade provision is going to be provided. If there's anything controversial, at least you don't dump the whole thing if the principle of unified government is accepted by the voters. I mean, that's basically what I had in mind, and I think it would really get it moving rather than run up into personalities, emotional issues, and technicalities, which I know has happened in that region. We haven't had it very much yet. Terry, how you got. I mean, that's basically the thing about it. I don't know whether you have any serious objections to it. If there are good objections to it, I'll listen, but this is momentum's a great thing. You get something moving, they're going to have to vote on it. If they vote the principle, then I think it's up to the assembly to implement it, not to argue over details of a charter.
Well, the other alternative was far, less in government. It was simply this, and this was based on the suggestion from the former mayor of Ketchikan, who's heading up the unification committee down there now. he feels at present time, the simple question that you put before the voters is misleading in that it says, shall they unify? And the guy who's kind of skeptical anyway says, hell no, I'm not going to sign that until after I've seen the charter, you know, I'm buying, taking a vote, I'm signing a blank check, and this sort of thing. So instead of asking that question, he decided to consider a change in the way the question is framed. And it just says, shall a charter commission be formed to prepare and submit to the voters a charter uniting the city and borough? That really doesn't represent very much departure from the present deal. But I don't think the present situation is a bad situation. In other words, I don't think you can force unification on anybody. I think the desire has got to well up from the people I know here. It was just a real spontaneous thing in Sitka at work. I don't know, you know, in Anchorage, I don't know what the problem is up there.
This is forcible when you put it on the ballot?
Well, yeah, I mean, if there's no interest in having it, they're gonna, even people that might not be interested in it are going to, you know, include it. I don't even know whatsoever. I don't know. I don't know. I'd just like to see the thing initiated by the people. I just feel like there's more for us to it if it's initiated by the people other than if they are mandatorily required to vote on it.
You've got unified government for a lot of reasons, one of which is your desire to create an image of the state that the capital should remain here, and I commend you for it. It's a wonderful thing. That motivation doesn't exist in many other areas of the state. And I think you set a terrific example that you admit that you had some terrible problems in the first stages of your unification fight, which we would like to eliminate. At least I would like to eliminate my area.
Yeah, well,
I have the people turn it, pass it, yes or no. And if they pass it, then let's continue on with the business. If they turn it down, let's forget it.
Yeah, but it only takes 25%, though, or is it 20%?
Get into this question of charter, too. You know that. That's what killed your first unification.
Oh,
that's the principle.
Yeah, but you still got that problem.
That's why I'm suggesting an amendment to the amendment to provide the charter representative sections the necessary at the discretion of the commission. In any event, I just, obviously, there's plenty of enthusiasm for it, though.
Well, I don't think that's the only amendment. Here's more thoughts on it.
Well, do I understand your proposal to mean that would they continue to vote on proposed charters until they finally accepted one? The commission could be conceivably in existence for 27 years?
Well, if they vote on the principle, the initial yes, then it would seem to me it's up to the commission to present an acceptable charter. And we drew up an amendment that would further change this amendment. And the last analysis, that charter's got to be approved in its entirety.
That's the way it is now.
Yeah, but the trouble is there's certain parts non-controversial and certain parts controversial, so maybe we can resolve them. But in any event, we've got a proposed amendment here.
That's been distributed, Mr. Chairman, Senator, in what Sandy handed out. Senator Sandy's redraft of the amendment of unification he's proposed last
week. Why don't you read your chart so you can understand the job?
Where is it?
Yeah, here it is. The last sentence is this amendment. Last three lines on below D, on section D, the provision of this act relating to unification otherwise governed unification, except that if the charter or private charter submitted by the commission or voter approval is rejected. And then it goes on to implement that.
Will somebody explain to me what it does? How does it work? What happens?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Chairman Senator Grove, you want to know what this revised amendment does?
Yes, sir.
This revised amendment retains what Senator Murphy proposed in his amendment last week, namely rephrasing the question of unification to having the decision made at the first election and then providing for a charter commission to come up with a charter. Incidentally, there are provisions for filling vacancies on that commission should they go on a number of years, as in the present law, and also requiring that the question be presented in all first and second class boroughs after the act takes effect. It retains, again, what he has in last week's amendment, and it, however, adds a provision in this revised form that the commission does not have to present the charter as a completed document. It may present it in portions and win approval of that and continue to go to the polls and build the charter, in effect.
Exactly right.
The charter commission.
When it's finally voted on, well, that's what was the issue here in June, though, and I'm certain it's going to be the issue in Fairbanks. And there's certain parts of the charter nobody disagrees on.
I'm thinking of McGaddy, assuming that you approve, say, a big bulk of the charter research provisions disapproved.
That's right.
And then you approve one of these next year and one the next year, and you've already approved this big bulk, but you don't put it back on.
That's right.
At what stage do you decide to
approve? When you finally get approval of an entire document.
Mr. Chairman, I only spent 1 year two nights a week writing a charter. Don, Representative Smith here spent 2 years doing it. Now, what do you think, Don?
I'd much rather just have one or two tries at it, put it away for a while. Just like we did.
I can feel another 19 to 1 vote coming in.
Well, to me, Terry, you know, the majority's not always great. I found that out. I showed that on one 19-1 vote. That's all right.
This morning, sir.
Hey, Don patted me on the back.
No, seriously.
Listen, I can't sell the free comics, but I have no pride about this shit. I mean, I laid about here, and if you guys been on the charter commission, we'd like to
probably. Well, he spent 2 years at it.
What about putting a deadline on it, on a commission?
There is a deadline.
That's nothing. You push yourself out against the war and say 2 or 3 years, whatever you want. But I think this will move them.
Well, there is a deadline now. You got to finish the charter within a year. Isn't that right? And it's got to be voted on within a year.
And
then you got a right to come back one time. So it's a two-shot deal right now. And what this would apparently propose to do is to, you know, then they could start presenting it in sections, I suppose. I don't know how you run into all kinds of questions as to what to present first, the preamble or the signature. No, I don't know, and I don't know what you present first. And of course, when you got to the gutty issue, you might have gone through 4 or 5 elections, and you wouldn't have made it anyway. I don't know.
I'd like to move along. Do we want to make a decision on this?
Well, I look through these here amendments. They're great, fixed up, and I like them. He has one mistake on there.
What's the one to talk about?
Well,
the new one?
First draft, 41172?
Yeah, revised it. There's a mistake.
Yeah, you just had a long line in case anybody was.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing oh. Serious.
Well, tell me about it, sir.
Page 113, instead of line 22, it should be line 21. Second item from the bottom.
Oh, okay, fine. What page are
you on? Yeah, you guys have something I don't know.
We're on page 61, Mr. Chairman, Senator Mertz, Mr. Harris, and Senator Grow there. Oh. Page 113, line 21, okay. So, that's only a technical amendment. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Does the committee, I don't have decided a basic policy question. May I quickly say, Mr. Chairman, that this legally, I don't think this question has any legal effect different than you already have under the unification law. In other words, right now they're really voting on the same question as phrased here. When they say, yes, we're for unification, but depending on the charter, in effect, under present law, they'll be saying the same thing when they vote on this question.
Yeah, you know what I mean? They understand it under this language, and they don't understand it the way it is now. They think they're buying a pig in a poke. And
I move its adoption, Mr. Chairman. The amendment.
The amendment on page 61 of
yes.
All right. You asking now some sense?
Yes.
Before we do, Cliff, would you agree to submit an add-on requirement
to go on
the ballot the next
generation
rather than going through,
I'm for that. I don't know how
I'd like to see that in the Sixth Amendment on 61, that clause, that have it go in this form.
You mean it goes on the ballot in every borough?
Yeah.
Except, you know, it's
except the
ones
that are
don't care about them,
I don't object to that. There are others
who... They're not close to the city
and borough separate. I've moved that the amendment to 61 amendment.
Okay. You're asking
an action sense? I object. You mean it automatically goes on the ballot?
No, on the form, but on a new form. On the form on 61.
What he's saying, Jess, so you have to... is that this section here in the proposed amendment...
Yeah.
At the next borough election, the question that we've approved in this amendment goes on the ballot.
And in each case, if they decide yes, then they go through the regular routine.
Now,
they've been fighting on the next issue for 4 years now, you know, start all over again.
Can I ask it, the reason for this?
Well, for example, it would bring the issue up at the next election and really clear the air, certainly not any other without the process.
Senator, let me make a suggestion to you. If you have any ambition as a statewide candidate and you pass this, you'll never be able to go to Eagle River.
Maybe I have a suicide. Yeah, I can sell to anybody and anything. If I'm
going to
run anywhere, the idea that you should vote on
it.
What's wrong with voting on it?
Well,
I
did twice.
Yeah, you can solve the problem, but in my area,
you have to put on the ballot would create a problem?
Yeah.
Why?
They'd come at me, what in the hell are you trying to start now?
I can't go to Eagle River. I don't see my brother should be.
All in favor of the proposition, I'll divide the question. First of all, we'll ask, do we approve of the language as contained here on page 61? Is there any opposition to the language?
As it's, yeah.
As submitted here on page 11, line 117.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask if that material in parentheses confuses the question or helps it? If you don't want it in there, I see no reason to leave it in there, but it doesn't hurt at the time.
I think it probably clarifies it.
Yeah,
the thing I'm worried about is that people, if they vote no, will figure they shouldn't vote on any charter commission members. That's the thing I'm trying to avoid, but I want to get the committee's decision on that.
Leave it in there.
Yeah. Okay, we'll assume then that this is adopted.
Okay.
The whole both pages?
No,
just this page 11, 111, line 17. Okay, now the other half of the question is, shall this be, question be mandatorily placed on the ballot in each city and borough, or each place there is a city and borough, in the next election? All in favor, raise their hands. All those. Okay, E for an honest effort. Okay, going on.
Listen, shouldn't we go on to other matters to hear Mr. Morehouse if we're going to quit at 9:30?
Yeah, I was going to see, are these real?
These are the toughest ones that we've gone through now. The rest, there are a number of strictly technical.
Why can't we get them next time?
Okay, let's just do that because I don't want to give a maximum amount of time to Mr. Morehouse here. So,
he may render all his work useless. Tired of this
stuff.
His beginning question is, do we really need local government?
Okay, well, I think
we
have
not been anything tonight yet.
Yes, just one deal. Just one item. We've done this more out there from the University of Alaska. Before we get into that, I want to ask a quick question. Now, Thursday night's the Filipino party. Is there some other night this week that anybody wants to get together? You want to get together tomorrow? Take then you don't want to meet until next Tuesday.
That's
right.
Right.
Okay, just so we know for sure. Okay, well then we'll hold all our other tentative amendments in abeyance then. We'll hear Tom Morehouse, who certainly has credentials in local government. Tom, do you want to pull up a chair here by the committee or wherever? Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I know you had to.
Graham, why don't you sit over here?
Right, yeah.
Okay,
right.
I'm going to sit down and have a cigarette.
Oh, sit right here. Oh,
yes, be careful with that.
Good luck. It's nice, dude. Hey, please. Play
we can do this any way you want to, Tom. If you want us to interrupt you as you go along, that's fine. Or if you'd like to make a presentation first.
Right. No, I'd appreciate the committee interrupting, providing you with guidance or questions or just your own comments about these issues or just steering away from what I'm talking about, because I haven't had the opportunity to see what you've been doing over the last couple of months. What I have here is a copy of the code as of February, I believe.
The amendments that probably were at all.
And also, while I was asked to come to discuss generally the code, I'm going to try to direct my comments primarily at what I've seen, what I've read, and not emphasize the theoretical, philosophical issues, except as I salt them around the things you're dealing with. I think generally, maybe this should go without saying, the code is certainly a step forward with the simplification and clarification of the basic laws affecting local government in Alaska. I think one of the principles that is reflected here, at least in part, and which should probably be maybe even strengthened, is to maximize local options across a whole range of affairs wherever there isn't a significant state interest at stake, or that is where the legislature shouldn't mandate one or another course of action. At the same time, the legislature should require the state should use its authority to do certain things where the state feels it has a vital interest in what goes on at the local level. And I see in several places where this has been done, for example, now authorizing second-class boroughs to exercise garbage collection, water pollution control outside the city. Another area that maybe in the future, and maybe not some in the far distant future, should be another area mandated or authorized without having to go through the area-wide, non-area-wide vote. There's nothing to help. I think the rationality of local boundary change is another area where the state has a legitimate interest, and the local boundary commission has a responsibility there. The financial solvency of local governments is another area that this bill certainly indicates the state has an interest in maintaining. So I see the need to balance these two principles, the maximizing local options and the insertion of state interest. So let me get down to an area that probably you've been spending a lot of time on and you have specific amendments before you've talked about, and that's the business of borough assembly structure and reapportionment. Basically, and this goes against the grain, I suppose, of the Anchorage City Council, but basically I think that one of the problems with borough government has been this confusion of borough and city roles, purposes, responsibilities. And this confusion and conflict between them, I think, has been reinforced and exacerbated by requiring, as it has been in the past, that the city council select members from it to appear to serve on a borough assembly. I don't know how it is in Anchorage. I know that in Fairbanks, the city council chooses its most junior members to take on this task, which others don't feel that they want to be bothered with. The junior members, I suppose, are implicitly mandated to watch out for the city's interest as interpreted through the city council. I think that this is not a good thing in principle. I think further it's not a good thing from the point of view of the voter in the city. The voter in the city does not have a direct interest, as expressed through voting, in helping to form the borough governing body. It votes for city council members. It does not know which city council member, unless they're very well informed, will serve on the borough assembly. These are people not running for seats which are labeled borough assembly member, city council member. So I think that is wrong. I think that the voter in the city, as well as outside of the city, should be voting directly for people who serve on the borough assembly, all in accordance with, I think, should be the principle of the differentiation of functions and responsibilities, and should be reflected in this arrangement whereby borough assembly members are chosen. I think that there should be a in the bill, in the basic general law scheme, with options, it should provide that the borough may choose either sections or at-large members, methods of selecting members on the borough assembly. In my own case, I much prefer and would encourage that sections be adopted in the interests of better representation and more manageability, interest, and responsiveness to voters in various areas of the borough, which gives them a more direct relationship to people on the assembly and reduces the psychological distance that now, even in small places like Alaskan Borough, you find between the average voter and the borough assembly member. Most voters, I would guess, even in Fairbanks, which is pretty small, couldn't name one or two, even, members of the borough assembly. And I think most.
Let me interrupt you, so I can just say what I'm thinking kind of is to say, it's not really reflected at all in the code. Mm-hmm. And that is, we thought, frankly, we would put the, first of all, probably just do the people in mm-hmm. constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. So that an amendment would just simply say that as long as the assembly is apportioned on the basis of one man, one vote, anything else is fair game. Mm-hmm. And that amendment being passed, then, mm-hmm. as we discussed tonight, mm-hmm. it would be up to the local city to decide whichever form they wanted. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to have an entire assembly elected at large, mm-hmm. they could do so. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to the entire area divided into sections, they could do so. Mm-hmm. If they wanted it city versus rural, mm-hmm. They could do so. Mm-hmm. Or if they, as Senator Grove pointed out, if they wanted to maintain the present situation where a city councilman is appointed, mm-hmm. That they could do so. Whatever they decided on would have to be voted upon and approved by the voters of the district. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't make approval or get approval from the voters within a specified length of time, then the local affairs agency would move in and they would make the decision for them. Mm-hmm. And in essence, that's what our decision.
This may be inviting situations in which the local affairs agency may have to move in.
Well, we recognize that in all other cases they're going to.
And which in effect will remove the actual decision on such a scheme from the local area and will put it into the state agency. Unless the law itself provides some guidance of both about the practicability and the constitutionality of schemes, I think you're going to find that there's going to be a great deal of wrangling in the local area over what is a desirable scheme. Some people will be very concerned about constitutional issues, others won't be aware of them, and there's going to be, I think, quite a conflict over this very issue. And I would guess that this is going to end up more often than not in the hands of the local affairs agency.
Well, we anticipate that frequently going to be the case, but the problem is that what worked out to be a pretty neat deal in one way, like Anchorage, for instance, is totally unresponsive in McKenna or in Mattsu or up in Bristol Bay. So that we just allow the absolute maximum local option just so that every borough can tailor its own assembly to its own particular geographical needs.
What I'm suggesting is that the options be somewhat narrowed down so that it isn't a completely wide open field.
that there are certain basic principles or guidelines that should be followed. And they begin with the one man, one vote. Of course, as much as it's not clear, actually, I should say, what you can do within the limits of one man, one vote. Of course, the doctrine is still evolving. But I do think that the legislature should be provided some limits and some guidance. And the kind of thing you're talking about, I don't see it could do that.
But gee, not to be argumentative, but why?
Well, by saying it's completely local option, it could be selecting city council members, it could be at large, it could be districts, it could be designated seats, it could be flooded seats, I suppose it could even throw in proportional representation, but it's wide open.
But if that satisfies the electorate, what's wrong with that?
Well, maybe the principle of throwing it wide open will satisfy some people. I think others will feel that they would like to have guidance, and I do think that there are some principles which are which should be applied here, and the legislature should apply them.
Well, maybe you could help with just an example of some criteria you're just thinking about.
Yeah, well, what I'd say is that basically, the option should be, you can choose sections or at large. You can also, an individual from the city could run both for a city council seat and for a borough assembly seat, but they would be separate seats, and you would run for them, in fact, separately. I think that comes about as far as I would want to go toward going back to this old way of having city council members automatically set up for a council. I think that beyond that, those kinds of options, and in the at-large, it could be with or without sectional residence requirements or with or without designated seats, but basically at-large or sections. And beyond that, if they want to work out something different, then it should go with charter route. And in working up a charter, which might include something even as exotic here as proportional representation, I would assume that they would have all the technical legal advice they need, as well as their own goals in mind for working out something that would be both constitutional and practicable in the area. But right now, as you're describing, I see it being too wide open. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
On the business of reapportionment, let me skip to that. I think that basically the reapportionment should be considered an executive function. It should be done. I saw a letter from Jim Bruce to Senator Hardy. I think that, you know, in a place where you have a borough chairman, it should be his function to propose a reapportionment plan, which would be subject, of course, to judicial review. I don't see that it's desirable to submit in either case, whether it's a borough chairman or a locally elected reapportionment board, submitting this to a borough assembly. I think the further you keep reapportionment away from an assembly, the better. And I think that it should meet both the political test, which would be faced by a borough chairman, and the constitutional test, which would be under review by the courts. Those should be the test of reapportionment, and not whether or not the borough assembly can agree who is going to be reapportioned out of the seat and who isn't.
What makes you think that the borough chairman is going to be any nicer to his political enemies than the assembly?
That's part of the political game. The governor has the authority under the state constitution to reapportion.
Sure, someone might disagree with that.
Shall we adjourn this?
The basic test of a reapportionment scheme is its constitutionality. And the governor has the authority as the executive of the state under our constitution.
What we're saying, Tom, is we're not for sure, based on our interpretation of that experience, that's all that good.
Well, I'm wondering what the alternatives are. You can turn the whole business over to the courts. You can turn the whole business over to the executive. But we know damn well you can't turn the business over to the legislature or the legislative body which is being reapportioned.
Well, I would agree with you if we hadn't, and theoretically you're correct, but if we hadn't put in that majority concept that's got to be ratified by the electorate, if we hadn't put them under the gun where they know that a state agency will come in and reapportion, I think those two factors tend to mitigate any gerrymandering and interpolitical maneuvering.
Proposal you're working on would submit this to the voters in a referendum?
Yes,
and the assembly?
Well, it would be an ordinance which would be approved by the...
Let's let it read in a minute.
And if they didn't ratify it within 6 months, then the local affairs agency would come in and...
Well, there you go again, back to the state.
Well, it's not a hell of a lot different if they do it than if the Superior Court judge does it. And that's about the only other alternative.
They know more about it.
No, I think it's better for a state executive agency to do it than a court.
Yeah. Well, that's about the only other alternative.
What would happen to what you're suggesting in the case of a borough manager?
I see that. That's where I see the local affairs agency and boundary commission.
Yeah, because right. We've got two borough manager steps now, and I kind of would guess that those places that don't unify will probably eventually go to that system, just the city's head.
Well, Well, one time when Mr. Smith and I were serving on the Anchorage Assembly, why the chairman decided that he'd get rid of one of the assemblymen, so he just redrew the section line. It worked. He took the section lines, like he had a section 4 here, and the guy lived here, and most of his strength was here, so he shifted the lines around and beat him out of office. Didn't he? So there's no reason to believe that the borough chairman is going to, you know, not wipe a guy out if he doesn't like him. I recognize, and I've read all the cases that say that legislative bodies are the worst ones to do it. There's a certain amount of merit to that. The only other choice, then, is to get to a nonpartisan reapportionment advisory board.
That's what we have.
Nonpartisan.
Well, I guess my basic point would be that I don't see that much useful will be accomplished by running through the assembly. That's it. Except, of course, another opportunity for a lot of rain. But now, that's all I have to say on that. I know you've spent a lot of time on it. I'd like to talk a little bit about the unification part, which you're dealing with.
Very good.
I see that you are not following the route, which I understand was being kicked around at one point, that the summer of the state legislature by fiat might mandate unification. I think it's wise not to do it. I think the whole experience of Burroughs shows what happens in such cases. I would, instead of attempting to shortcut or end run the problem of unification, which is a problem because there are real political differences and conflicts among various groups or areas within the borough, what I would see at best is attempting to streamline a little bit the existing process by which unification reaches the ballot, and this is what I think you're dealing with. The kinds of thoughts I had on it, which I think are consistent with what you were talking about earlier, is that it would be optional to go either the petition route or a borough ordinance to put on the ballot the question of unification. Secondly, I think that the wording of the petition, which you were discussing, and the ballot should be different than what you have now in the law, which is analogous to this question about the state constitution. Because the question is not really, shall we unify? The question is, shall we elect a charter commission to prepare something that we may want to adopt? And I think that should be, and I don't know whether you've adopted that.
Yeah, that's what we're doing now. Yeah,
right. Good.
He's got a good point, though, about perhaps giving the assembly the power by ordinance to place it before the election.
Yeah, that is.
Not a bad idea. That's a compliment.
Extraordinarily watered down, wasn't it?
Most compromises are watered down, Pete thinks.
You know, it's kind of silly not to. Even the assembly or the city council. Originated.
Good idea.
I would see the assembly as a logical body.
Yeah,
well, it's logical, except, you know, why not put in both things and let either one of them write it? One sees the name, the other doesn't.
Right. There's no great risk of a policy-making group enacting an ordinance to put something on the ballot where the people vote.
Thank you.
Okay.
Greg, you want to draft something to that effect?
Sure. Yeah.
What I would further do, and this goes a little bit further, is eliminate the requirement for a dual or a concurrent majority on the question of whether or not there shall be a charter commission. That isn't the critical question. The critical question is whether a charter shall be adopted. I think on the general proposition of creating a charter that people can look at, again, there's another check for them. They look at it and decide whether they want it or not. There is a dual majority. But why use a dual majority in the first place when they're voting on an abstract issue which many people read many different things into? What does unification mean? To some people, it means beefing up a unit of government. Another, it means tearing it down. Now, they mean quite different. Unification means quite different things to quite different people. There are some strange bedfellows in the unification movement. And therefore, I think that the general proposition of unification is close to meaningless, although the principle is clear enough. I mean, the general principle is clear enough that you don't like what you have now. That's what it means. So on that score, I would eliminate that dual majority at that point. There would be an area-wide majority on the question of whether or not the Charter Commission should be established.
Let me just throw other thoughts to direct. To me, the only real advantage of having the dual majority, even at that early stage, is that, for instance, if a rural area is just flat against it, and then, you know, and they come in 75% no's on the question, really, it's fair to these 11 people to put them through a year of anguish, and then with the almost certainty that they're going to be defeated.
I would assume that if the rural or non-city area was so fully against it, that neither the assembly nor the people who petition would put it on the ballot, if it was that clear. But even in those cases where you find people adamantly against boroughs and unification, they still have, in a couple of cases, voted for the general proposition on the ballot. So I think as a practical matter, this is, may not be a strong argument.
But isn't it, I don't mind that, but doesn't that just mean that 11 people work for a year writing a charter and then it gets shot down because they don't have any indication, like Mike says, what the people on the outside feel? Yeah.
That's the only worry I've got.
Yeah.
Well, that's worth thinking about later on.
Well, the point that I'm saying is that what is it that you know about how they feel when they vote for, let's say, unification in principle?
You don't know too much.
You don't.
But if they vote no, you do.
Well, you know this much, don't you? Isn't it pretty well the experience factor that people have been willing to allow the commission, they've been willing to go along to the extent that the commission will work on unification, and that question's been far more acceptable to the electorate than the final document itself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't sell the easy question, there's no sense in even trying to sell the hard one. That's the theory behind it, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see the logic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, the good experience would be what happened in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have no comments on unification. I've picked out a number of other issues that I feel are fairly important. I put them in sort of descending order in my mind of importance, although they're not quite that way. I got a group of comments on some basic structural questions. One very good, the proposed code gets away from the four classes of citizens. That's nonsense. It's accrued over time. How about looking at the boroughs? Why maintain three classes of boroughs when the only difference is the planning and zoning power? At the same time that you're maintaining the three classes, you are requiring that home rule in first class cities, with the new first class cities including many small remote rural places, having to add planning and zoning. Can't Haines add planning and zoning? Why maintain three classes of boroughs for Haines, which was an expedient so that they could meet the Constitution and the law, but it's really the old school district of doing labor.
I think we were kicking that around, not so much in the pre-conference, but on the original concept. And I mean, it's correct or wrong. I think probably most of our thinking was we didn't want to take too many radical changes,
mm-hmm.
because from a practical standpoint, we never get two votes out.
Yeah.
And that may be in that category.
That's your judgment to make.
Yeah.
But is it radical? Do you think, what's your rationale?
My basic rationale is that the borough and the city are municipal, they're units of general municipal government. And as units of general municipal government, they should be distinguished from units of special purpose or special function government. And I think it's somewhat of a deception to have something you call a borough, which is a school district with another name. Maybe that isn't a terribly weighty rationale. Maybe it's because I'm too enamored of neatness in the law. But I just see that as it was special interest legislation which provided a precedent and restructured, in effect, the Bayesian borough law. And I don't think it was a good precedent.
Well, Tom, the reason we enacted that was we were hoping that places like Haines, like the Petersburg Wrangell area, some of these Delta Tope, Glen Ellen, would in the absence of going to a borough, would go to a third class borough, some semblance of a school district, which is what it was. Obviously, it hasn't worked. That was the reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just for Haines. We thought we could also sell it to other communities.
But you see, what that does, it provides an out for areas which might better go with the annexation route when it's only relatively minimal areas which would have to be included in general government. What you're doing is giving them an easy out and an incentive to go to a special district.
If they didn't even do that, Tom. They didn't need to do that.
But you give them an incentive for that. And I don't think it's a good
one. I don't even think there's been another election for third class group.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Tom. I think we're to wipe it out. Trade Haines up.
Make them a second class
group. Yes, sir.
But now you're also under this code adding health or refuse control. What else?
That's permissive, isn't it?
No. Well,
that's permissive, but it doesn't require it with the people.
It's automatic power of the borough.
But it's permissive. They
by ordinance.
They don't have to.
By ordinance.
Yeah, they have to exercise an ordinance.
They must pass an ordinance to assume.
No.
Power?
No.
Okay. Well, that I think should take care of it.
But the third class borough does have one good feature, and we changed the code to this effect. And that is, we said a third-class borough, if they wanted to, when they graduated second class, could retain the one-body combination school board deal. And in a place like Haines, I think it's kind of a neat deal. I don't know if it'll work or not, if Juneau or not, but in a small community like Haines, it's not really all that shabby.
I still think that too much turns on Haines, which is an exception.
Well, I would use it as an example.
And further, I think that I would take that principle that you just mentioned a step further and provide the same option to home rule, first class and second class boroughs, city boroughs, and cities as an option. Now, there are probably most places won't exercise it, but I think it's a good principle to provide the option for those who may, and it seems a logical thing and probably even a desirable thing in a place like Crystal Bay, even in the hands of people. And it may be so other in other places as well.
Well, we considered that. Don't we have money for that effect under consideration?
I think that's very good, and that, again, takes care of your cancer problem. That rationale would be seen
Did you get that point, Greg, that the 500 ADM limitation, only in birth, 500 ADM, less than a vote to combine a school board for assembly? Will let anybody vote on that? That's what Terry and I were talking about.
Yes, I thought that was in there.
I think it is.
I
code drops 500 ADM?
Yeah, let them vote on it. In other words, it's awesome.
Well, the code didn't. We have to amend it.
Well, it's got a vote. Remember that?
So there's an amendment, though, under consideration.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll have to check the record.
Here, Tom,
I don't send me what we've done earlier. I know, but I the committee did an awful lot earlier. It's hard to digest it.
Yeah, well, that's certainly something we can continue to consider. I appreciate how much time.
The next thing here I have is just a couple of comments on the question of the unorganized borough. I think it's probably very desirable, and I think you've already agreed, not to attempt to do something in the revised bill or even a separate legislation this year in organizing in some fashion the unorganized borough.
House of Governors passed up 506. It's in finance. I don't know where it's going to go beyond that, but it's there.
And I understand that a report will be requested from the legislative council on the whole question. Is this correct?
No, the report would be on the subject of taxing and the property tax in the unorganized borough. This is in lieu of the governor's House Bill 597. Yeah, $15 million tax.
I see. It does not ask for a study of the question of organizing.
No, we sent that out due back.
Today, we brought to that vote of government the Senate the question of organization of unorganized borough. It's going to be considered next Thursday, 13th. The governor's coming down with the recommendations and narrative report on it and so forth. So it's very much alive.
For legislation this year to
organize?
I think this is very premature, especially in light of the fact that the time, energy, and resources of most of the people affected in rural Alaska are really being devoted to and should be devoted to organization for land claims.
Here, here.
Further, the various areas of unorganized Alaska are very contrasting in their structure, makeup, and population economies, and you cannot come up with a fairly an easy, simple scheme which is going to make sense in the various parts. Take a look at Southeast, take a look at South Central, take a look at the vast Northwest region. This is not an easy question, and that's another reason why I think it's very critical.
You probably ought to conform to the regionals.
In some places,
and you need the regionals before you can conform. That's why we need another year.
But you see, what you do with the Copper River Valley area, or the area around Valdez and Seward, Cordova, you see, what do you do there? You can't overlap. You know, that just doesn't make sense when you look at it. But whereas it may make sense elsewhere, like in the North Slope or wherever. Well, in any case.
Tom, when you come to our local government committee meeting on Thursday, you see a representative trying to change who's going to prepare the narrative.
Well, why don't we get Mr. Fisher down at the same time?
He's in favor of
bringing Mr. Fisher in because he's 100% office in the testimony of Mr. Morehouse.
I think Rick is having second thoughts all
over. I hope so.
I'm not sure of that, but we talk about these things sometimes.
We've had them since last Thursday.
On 596, I just might miss one thing we did do in the House. We put an amendment on that, but at least two sets of hearings would be held in the areas to be affected. Once at the very beginning, when tentative thoughts are being tossed around, and then later, once the boundaries have been more or less established by the, this is the Boundary Commission task. Once the thing has been more or less established, then an additional public hearing would be held back in the district so that people would have an opportunity to comment on the were being informed. It seems to me that this is the time to make sure that those boundaries, wherever it's logical, are concurrent.
Well, they will be there. The regional corporations will be there. And they won't go away. And therefore, I don't see that as a compelling reason for moving. But at the same time, I mean, really, it's a time and a half, a double time job to do what is being done now in rural Alaska.
Proud of you, Tom.
I don't know if the Assistant Attorney General's proud of
him. As you can
all
see,
I got to do is draw lines the first year anyway. Right? I mean, under the bill, all that would happen the first year is that lines would be drawn. I gather the very probable outlines of the claims reasons are perfectly well known. At this time, any conforming that was appropriate could be carried out in the bill. I would certainly agree that if the effect of this bill were to push organization immediately in the process, this would be too much of a burden for the rural people to carry the same funds and be able to claim. But of course, that's not what happens. The organization aspect of it is postponed indefinitely until people feel ready to move forward.
But in some places, those lines are going to be easy to draw, but there are cases where they're going to be very difficult to draw.
I grant you the lines will be difficult to draw, and they'll always be difficult to draw.
Well,
Sure, why don't you go on, yeah.
I have a little item here that may be one of those controversial areas on the face of it. This has to do with the required nonpartisanship in local elections. Now, of course, it would be a minor revolution if it were to require partisanship. But what I'm suggesting is that you consider providing as a local option partisan local elections. Now, I'm saying that because study after study of the question of the impact or effect or consequences of nonpartisanship show that voter turnout is always lower, voter interest is lower, voter understanding is lower of issues and questions and candidates in nonpartisan cities. I'm not saying, and I wouldn't expect that if there were an option that Alaska cities would rush towards partisanship, but I think in keeping with the principle of allowing local options, experimentation where people wish to, that they should be allowed the option of partisanship in local elections. I think, by the way, that this is consistent with some things you're already writing into this code, which are permitting wards, or let's say districts and cities, as well as in boroughs. I think it's consistent with the proposed timing of elections, unless you change that. The timing of elections making state and local elections coincident. This helps increase voter interest and voter turnout. And the problem with local elections, as you all know, is a dismal turnout, which doesn't speak well for the representativeness of the decisions made.
Well, yes, sir. I make notes on the Town Center merge. It's also being recorded.
We can discuss this as we go along.
Okay.
Would you also, we talked privately today about the proposed amendment which would require at least a 40% vote before a person could be considered elected. Mm-hmm. What's your views on that?
I'm very much in favor of that. Simply because, as a matter of principle, or maybe as a matter of practicality, I think that the more people that can get their second or third choice into office, rather than their third or fourth or fifth choice, if they had a chance, that's all to the better. And when you have an election which is strictly on a plurality basis, people who voted for a guy who came in fourth on a three-man race, if they had a second choice,
three-man race,
and a four-man race, wouldn't have voted for the guy who came in first. They might have voted for the guy who came in second or third. And the plurality election denies that kind of representativeness of the choice. And if you require that 40% or more, it takes 40% or more to elect, you're going to get closer to that ideal state where more people get their higher choices into office than their lower choices. It's a mathematical business. And I think 40% is a good compromise figure in terms of how often it might be necessary and extra added expense and time and energy of elections.
Well, it's true. You notice how many elections that the runner-up loses and the number two man loses and they run off race? And the third or fourth man usually down the scale wins. The very reasons he's talking about when they make that final choice that they still not get to live with.
Well, I have a few more of these structural items, and one maybe that you're more concerned with and have been dealing with is the question of the assumption of additional borough powers and how that's done on either an area-wide or a non-area-wide basis. In the first place, I'm not exactly clear from reading the proposed code what the exact requirements are for the assumption of area-wide powers. Is transfer by a city like the petition route? Both, are they both subject to election? Or is transfer by a city, in the case of area-wide powers, done simply by borough ordinance?
Tom, how could a city transfer an area-wide power?
It would simply, if a city now has, let's say, water supply or sewer authority, and the rest of the borough doesn't, and it's a first-class borough or a second-class borough, it could transfer the borough to area-wide administration. Now, I'm not clear in that case whether that is subject to an election, as would be a petition for an election. And
this is not subject to an election. This is in the same method of first class borough. The city passes, the city or cities, as the case may be, pass an ordinance transferring the power of the assembly, passes an ordinance accepting it, and the transfer is complete.
That's on first class borough.
That's on first class borough. Yeah. That's the transfer by a city, though.
Yeah.
The mechanics of it. There is no election in the
first class
transfer.
But in a second class borough, it has to be.
It has to be by vote.
Has to be by, yeah. And
basically, we could giants get backward on that one, by the way, Tom.
Well, we just maintain present law.
It is the present law, isn't it?
No, I'm talking about an assumption of area-wide powers.
Now,
well, actually, that's just, we assume the present law.
So in other words, without an election, a first-class borough can assume the power and start exercising it without an election, because it's already got the power to, actually, the non-area-wide, non-city area.
Yeah,
but assume the power by ordinance, then to assume the power in a non-city area.
Right, so the assumption is that the people, by voting in a first-class borough in the first place, were willing to go on with the power. Right. Okay, now for the non-area-wide, in the case of the second-class borough, is the election which is required, is this an outside-the-city election only, or is it an area-wide election that the law doesn't seem to say, the proposed code doesn't seem to say?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might interject here. This, I think page 54 and 55 of the main bill, SB 113, covers this question of additional area-wide powers. First, I am under the impression, these provisions pretty much copy the existing Borough Act provisions, almost verbatim. And there has been difficulty under the existing interpretation of the existing provisions, and the matter was hassled over in committee deliberations many, many times, and it was decided that the policy implications and everything better require a leaving the provisions as they are and the continuance by the courts of defining them. The gaps are not that great, however. You first have a constitutional provision that says a city may transfer any power to the borough assembly, and if the assembly accepts it, the assembly can exercise it within the city. A transfer from one city wouldn't automatically confer an area-wide power, however. Whether a transfer from all cities confers an area-wide power has been debated. The city may also, under the Constitution, revoke the transfer of power. And here's where you get into some of the complications we've had. I mean, can you, in effect, transfer and create area-wide powers by all cities transferring and the assembly assuming the power on a non-area-wide basis? And then when the city revokes, what happens? These are the kinds of questions which have been hassled over. I do have a question, though, as to whether a transfer isn't by ordinance in the case of both the first and second class borough.
Under the code?
Under the code.
Yes.
Yes, there doesn't have to be a vote of the people for a city to transfer, to the borough.
No. Under the code, both the first and second class boroughs can area-wide powers acquire them identically. They may acquire them either by transfer or by election.
It's line 13
and 14,
554.
I think it's a present law, too.
Yes, that is present law, isn't it?
What was your question again, Tom?
Well, I'm trying to clarify this, and the present law I find confusing also.
You asked the question.
What I'm saying, okay, in the case of a first-class borough, if it assumes an area-wide power by transfer, I think this is logical because the people have voted in as a first-class borough. In the case of a second-class borough, to assume an area-wide power by transfer without a vote is to circumvent a vote which the first-class borough went through when it was made a first-class borough. In other words, the people didn't vote that power to the second-class borough. It was simply transferred. The people in the non-city areas may or may not agree that they want that service or that they want to pay the taxes that are required. So I would think that if there's a difference between first and second class, it's that added check, that added procedural check in suing Charles, that should be reflected in the law.
Incidentally, are you aware that the Senate amended the language on page 55 to say that the vote on the question of adding an airwide tower shall be tabulated in two separate classifications. One consists of all votes cast in home rule in first-class cities of the borough, and the other in all votes cast the remainder of the borough. In other words, we added the dual majority concept in that. It's not reflected in your amendment.
Does that apply to first-class boroughs as well?
No, second-class boroughs.
Second-class boroughs.
That's new language to the code.
I see. On area-wide powers.
Yes.
How about non-area-wide powers? And this, what I'm driving at here now, non-area-wide powers in the case of the second-class borough. In the case of the second class borough, in the case of non-area-wide powers, is the election, now the election route, is that election held area-wide in the non-city area, in both, are there dual majorities or not required? Because what I'm driving at is that logically, the election should only be in the non-city area, because that's the only area affected by the assumption of a non-area-wide power. And that it should be a strictly a simple majority in the non-city area, and the law should say that.
Mr. Chairman, if I can comment on this further, I understand what you're saying is that a first-class borough now can exercise any power in the area outside a city that a city may exercise.
Yeah.
They don't need an election.
Yeah.
A second-class borough has to have an election in that area outside the city. Right, in the area outside any city in the borough. Okay, so if in a first-class borough, all the cities transfer to the borough a power, and the borough may already exercise it in the area outside the city automatically without a vote of the people. In effect, you have created an area-wide power, and that is what is contemplated by the language here,
right,
assuming additional area-wide powers. You're raising the question, though, in a second-class borough where the city may transfer to the borough, do you have to have a vote of the people in the non-city area if all cities transfer, or can the second-class borough automatically go area-wide? Excuse me.
I'm talking about a non-area-wide power, not an area-wide power.
Yes. Whether you need a vote in a second-class borough?
Yes.
So only in the area outside the cities.
See, the law does not say only in the area outside the cities. And that's why I'm raising the question.
The code doesn't say that.
It ought to say it.
It ought to say it to make it clear that the people affected are the people who vote.
Where is your non-area-wide provision? Non-area-wide.
Well, it would be 55 and 56, Senator Mertes. Let's see, 55 at the bottom line, 27 deals with the first-class borough. Second-class borough is on page 56, starting at line 4. I'll be surprised if you're not required to have a vote to assume a non-area-wide power in a second-class borough.
The point is, it should just be in the area outside the city, and there ought not be an area-wide election to assume a non-area-wide power. As I understand your question.
On page 56, it's in 1 and 2, and probably what you're suggesting is to add a 3 there and say that this election would be conducted only in the areas
outside
where
the non-area
would be exercised.
The non-city area.
Right.
And line 24 has ordered an election, you can just simply say outside. Or an election on the question outside the city, or an election outside the city, in the area outside the city, on the question.
It isn't really clear, it's a good point. It ought to be added in, right?
Yes.
The outside of cities.
You mean at line at on 56 at line 25?
Yeah. Make a new 3. Make it 3.
Oh, well, no, you're suggesting here at line 25.
The area outside cities.
Area outside cities.
Order an election on the question of the area outside cities. Does the present law omit that reference too?
This is exactly the present law. Deliberately drafted, the Lee Committee did not need present law on the subject. We recognize the ambiguity and deliberately did not solve it.
Even the Lee Drafting Committee, not even know.
No, we've sat down that.
Well, as a practical matter, the question has never come up, has it?
It came up when we were the Lee Committee working on this.
I mean, in the court.
I've never lived in a second-class borough, so I don't know. That's news to me. I just assumed this is the way it was.
And the leaders say they weren't in town.
Wish all they didn't get away with it. I think one further point on the question of the assumption of powers. We discussed earlier that the legislature would permit second-class boroughs to exercise garbage collection water pollution control powers. I think where the state does have a genuine and real interest in seeing that those powers are actually exercised, but you don't want to mandate them, that some thought should be given to means of providing financial incentives for them to assume them, maybe above and beyond what is now provided in our revenue sharing.
Greg, do you want to make a note to draft a phrase there on page 56?
Yes,
I
have that.
But we do if we drop the line. The existing law does say qualification of voters, any person who is a qualified voter in Alaska and is a resident of the borough and area outside the city is qualified to vote.
Yeah, but you should also make it...
Well, this is what is confusing me. There's never a problem on
that's
the present law.
That's the existing law. We dropped the line.
Well, where did you drop it? That's one the league dropped that I didn't catch. There were many they dropped that some we caught, but I see. That was on 0750. Where is that in the code, though? The same provision in the code. Okay.
It should be right here. Either that or this section got dropped, qualification of voters got dropped out of this section.
So very good.
This got dropped. It should have been in.
As long as the league dropped it, I don't remember any committee of the legislature having dropped it. What was the league's reasoning in dropping it?
Well, you want to...
Fine, we'll make that correction. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, I think that the clearer the law can make what is the distinction between first and second class boroughs, the better. Just for matter of that's all I have on this business of politics. Now, I have a couple of just general comments to make on, I'm not terribly knowledgeable in the area of public finance and taxation and so on, but I look at two parts of the proposed bill dealing with property sales and use taxes. One which provides the opportunity to pyramid, which of course exists now, property and sales taxes, when you have a city and a borough. It does provide one limit, which says that the total amount of property taxes cannot exceed 3% of assessed value.
We changed that. Now you can have 3% in the city and 3% in the borough.
There is no limit on the imposition of sales taxes. That 3% of assessed valuation can still be pretty hefty. And so it does continue the policy of, if not encouraging, providing the opportunity for greater reliance on regressive taxes at the local level. Further, another part of the code continues the policy of required exemptions for certain classes of property, and then provides the opportunity for further exemptions at the local level, which compounds the problem of regressivity because it provides, in effect, at the local level, the equivalent of oil depletion allowances and capital gains loopholes and so on at the federal level. In other words, the property tax base shrinks as the properties are exempt, which exacerbates the regressive problem. And I'm not saying that you're causing this, I'm saying that the code provides the opportunity and wherewithal to bring about that problem and to make it worse. Maybe the answer to that is really a practical political one when the state does come into some sort of significant wealth, that this would be taken care of in other ways. I'm just talking about the principle which is reflected in the code.
As a matter of fact, I think Mont 7 has a House Bill 598, which 598 which triggers a pretty significant kickback from the White
House. Mm-hmm. Can I translate your principle into code language that you suggested?
I think I would really like to see, if not now, because this is an issue that deserves a lot of attention on its own merit, that the legislature take a very close look at required exemptions and the rationale and the justification for them and the impact that these exemptions have on local government revenue. You know, in some places this has really gotten out of hand. I'm not talking about Alaska now because I don't have specific knowledge of what is the exact dollars and cents. But this is a major problem in local government elsewhere, property tax exemptions, which run incredibly from 30% to 50% of a local property in some places. And this really puts the squeeze on and makes things much, much worse than they would be.
Yeah. We did is we tightened up this one permissive deal that said you could give exemptions for property, and we put in the word residential.
Mm-hmm.
So so that we didn't create a new little mini industrial incentive in the process.
What about the sales tax? The borough has different exemptions than the city sales tax. Shouldn't we require something there to make it clear? The borough ordinance is different from the city ordinance. Thinking
it's a matter of state policy. What would you comment on that? Very good. Yeah, my understanding of the
what your comments on state policy requirement.
I say my basic problem is not with the food tax is exactly what, it's the fact that both are taxing them. There's a 5% sales tax in the city of Irvine. I think that's really lousy. As a taxpayer, I think that.
That wasn't his question, though,
Tom.
You just want to protest, huh?
Yeah.
What's the page on
page 93?
I really don't have any.
This is line 47. 440, I think that's what you're talking about. Line 21? On page 93, line 27, I think that's what you're suggesting. That this language, it's actually language here.
Yes.
Line 29, it's all versus tax.
They have to levy on the same source. Yes, that language is misleading inadvertently, I sometimes think, because it means, in effect, Mr. Chairman, that a city within a borough, when the borough levies and collects a sales or use tax for area-wide borough functions, must levy upon all sources and the same sources taxed by the borough. And that's it. They can't levy on additional or different. Well, legally it reads that way, but I've been surprised a number of people have not got the point of that.
It's still amazing. Talks about area-wide borough functions.
Yes, well, it wasn't my language. I mean, as draftsman, I don't know whose it was. Was it the leaves?
Isn't that a policy, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Isn't that a policy that you suggest that we, state policy, that we require the ordinances, sales tax ordinances, to be consistent both as to exemptions and method of administration and so forth?
I would assume that people who administer these taxes and people who have to collect them in stores and so on would appreciate that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the provision does do that, and I assume it binds home rule. I'd have to look at the supplements.
Why don't we check that out?
Yes, okay.
A bit later. Go ahead.
Do we agree that it's a good idea?
I think we all agree it's a good idea, but I don't know if we ought to mandate it. I mean, they can do it now. For instance, in Juneau, just before unification, it took us a long time to do it, because we had a fairly active committee, Greg and I were both on, as a matter of fact. And did just this very thing. We got the two cities in the borough together, and after many long evenings, we finally came up with a uniform sales tax procedure. We weren't charging the same amounts in each place, but we had the same exemption, same rules, same everything.
Nowhere anywhere else in the state, is that the case?
But I'd like to turn this around, and what I said earlier is that I'm not so happy to see it made easier to use sales taxes. And this is what it does. And I wish that there were less reliance and less preferences, and as well as less incentive or encouragement to use them.
Well, amen to that. I do too.
And since you're done with it,
I'm certain glad to see Mr. Morehouse come back to the first part of his question, the very statement. Because most exemptions that local property tax have now are state mandated. And we've got four or five more in this legislature. By counting 19 and 1 to 8, there may be state mandated later on in this session. And every time you
did they one of those days for you, Don?
Every time you take something out of local property tax, we get to go to the sales tax or something. Almost everyone in that list is state.
I can concur with you on the other. That was the whole idea of my revenue sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the same time, I hope that the legislature will sometime in the future take a close look at the required exemptions for property tax. Annexation by local action. I see that you're trying to require that the local boundary commission prepare regulations for annexation by local action, which would also require that these regulations include a provision for a vote by the area to be annexed, which is really carrying forward practice from the past. My concern with that is not that the area to be annexed should not have some voice about whether or not they should be annexed. It's whether they will use this borough service area as an easy way of blocking annexation that makes sense. And I would hope that if this route is chosen, the local boundary commission at the same time would pay attention to the misuse of the service area for the purpose
of blocking annexation when it does make sense, and that's a kind of, when it makes sense to the judge, they should be exercising. I think that the provision in the code which allows cities to establish differential tax zones could take some of the sting out of annexation. I think that's a step in the right direction, too.
Yeah.
I would hope further that the requirement in the regulations from Moose Boundary Commission would not create implicit pressure against the local boundary commission exercising its authority from the state level in the matter of annexations. And I'm afraid it might.
Well, I know what he's saying.
But say it again.
The fact that you're going to make official that annexation by local action is a route to take, and that whenever you do it, the area to be annexed must vote on the question, this will provide a great deal of pressure against the Boundary Commission from exercising its annexation powers from the state level.
You mean that's in there now?
No, he's saying because it's in there, it's giving them a moral argument. In effect, say, we turn it down, now don't do it as a matter of state policy. He's saying, isn't that in effect what you're saying?
Yes.
And I agree with that.
Well, isn't that the situation as it exists right now, though?
Yeah, but we're putting this procedure in, which isn't there. Where is it? What page is it?
Page 107, Mr. Chairman, beginning with line 21. This, again, though, only refers to the constitutional option given to the local boundary commission to prescribe procedures for annexation by local action, subject to law.
Mm-hmm. That's the Constitution says it may.
May. Well, that's why I say it's an option given to them to do it.
But the phrase subject to law is an interesting one.
Yes, this whole chapter assumes that that's a pretty powerful phrase, that the law can, in effect, mandate the commission
to
prescribe.
Change that to Michelle.
Excuse me, in your question, Mr. Chairman, I have a question
to raise.
Two shells on lines 19 to 16, I think they should be named made, no mandate, and that's your point. You're mandating them to do this, and it's implied when you're mandating that that puts a lot of credence on the vote outside the city. And I think that's a change to may, but we haven't heard it at all.
Well, you need a shall in the first one, because that's just saying the Boundary Commission shall do it within 90 days, it shall promulgate.
Cedars don't have to,
just
let them do it if they want to. They don't have
to.
Well,
no,
it's within 90 days in there.
Just strike all the Guardian language. It's in the Constitution anyway,
if you
don't do that.
But, well, I mean, it just was pointless. It's even strength to a vote outside in this square is as a matter of moral pressure. Mm. Maybe moral pressure. It's a bad word. Vested interest.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one for you? You usually have a quitting time here, and if Tom is here, I'd like to know how much more he's got to go, because I've got some general overall questions on local government that I'd like to inquire of him on.
I'll try to interrupt this, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Wording of standards for Berman Corporation. I have one point there. On page 9, line 10. The economy encompasses a trading area with human, etc., etc. That phrase does not make much sense. Just think of how can an economy encompass anything, especially a trading area, and what is a trading area? Now, one could pick out in various parts of these these standards similar things in triple them, but I think that this question of the trading area is an outstanding example of the problem of definition. A trading area is like a set of Chinese boxes, and where you draw the line is a matter of judgment. That problem of ambiguity within a statement, which is ambiguous in itself, I think creates problems. And I as a suggestion, maybe to tell you what I'm driving at, I think that I should simply say that the economy of the area includes the human and financial resources, and let it go at that. Otherwise, I find it a very confusing statement.
Let's make that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
You're putting that in motion?
Yes.
I'd like to ask Rich, do you see any problems with that? I know that prior to the, for instance, the North Slope Borough, you were wrestling with a lot of these very paragraphs. That's the reason
I certainly agree. There's no more persuasive object lesson on the confusion of this term than the North Slope Borough decisional meeting. It's a complete mystery. I'm sure everybody had to deal with it. As far as that goes, I think it's a good idea to get rid of it.
Okay,
it's sort of redundant anyway. It's a circular definition is what it sounds.
Would you repeat that again then?
The economy,
I think you've got it.
The economy of the area includes the human and etc.
It's been moved that we adopt that as amendment.
You don't even need the word economy, do you? You're going to talk.
Well, I think you should use the word because it's taken from the four terms used in the Constitution.
population, economy, transportation, and character. So, read, the economy of the area includes the human and financial resources capable of providing, etc.
But the area includes human and economic resources.
What's the etc. now? Say it again, do the whole thing, so we all make sure it holds up.
I'm reading from page 9, line 10, and on. The economy of the area includes the human and financial resources capable of providing local services. Evaluation of the area's economy includes land use, property evaluation, etc.
Well, let's go on. It's getting late. We've got a suggestion.
That amendment is adopted then. Hearing no objection.
Now, the temporary succession to the borough chairman's office, on page 24, lines 21 and 23 to 223, it provides that in temporary absence or illness or what have you of the borough chairman, the presiding officer of the assembly shall fill the borough chairman's office. I believe that the man who is next in succession should be an executive official and probably say the borough attorney rather than and a legislative official. I think that this makes some difference in the larger boroughs where you do have executive officials appointed by the chairman and where continuity of executive policy, explanations, information is important, which could be quite different from what a presiding officer of the borough assembly might have in mind when dealing with the responsibilities of the borough chairman's office.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Morris. We had a real serious problem on this. I don't remember whether Don and I were on the assembly at the time, but the chairman left town. The presiding officer became chairman, and he vetoed a bill that the chairman was strongly in favor of. Then he came back on the assembly, and he voted on the veto.
Well, wouldn't it be better to have a manager designate rather than saying the borough attorney?
No, I would say the chairman should designate an administrative official, and I would assume that the borough attorney would be a logical one.
Right. Well, then the language would be that it wouldn't be named the borough attorney. Designated by the chairman.
Well, if you can give me the citation again, I can't seem to find it.
24
line. What does that say? 20.
I think lines 20 to 23.
Yeah, the first sentence is. You see, an elected official takes over. I mean, that elected official takes over from the chairman.
I see.
In his point.
I was, man.
I
took over that borough one once. Every time Slipper left town, man, I was there. Who took it over in your charter?
We had a provision in the charter about his chief administrative officer.
Okay, we'll put that down.
Well, I'll tell you what.
By the borough chairman.
I'm not sure I can buy that one. I want to think about it. I might be able to buy it if this person who the chairman designates is confirmed by the assembly, which is not terribly unlike the way we do it here at the state.
It could be done by
the lieutenant governor designate is confirmed by the legislature. There should be, if you're going to give that man all those sorts of powers, he should have some sort of public check.
Yeah, I would say some sort of chairman's disability succession ordinance, whatever you want to call it.
It's worth exploring.
Yeah, we'll consider that further. Did you pretty well get the sense?
Yes, sir, except that you haven't decided who you want to substitute for the
somebody
assembly
presiding
officer.
Somebody designated by him. Somebody designated by the chairman and approved by the assembly.
Okay, so we'll submit an amendment to that effect.
Yeah, I still want to think about that. That's
the argument against it is that at least if you put a presiding officer in, you've got another elected official.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
I'm not sure that I wouldn't go there. What happens if we have permanent, what if we have a death or a resignation? What happens?
Well, that's covered in filling vacancies.
Yeah. That's not temporary.
You do have filling vacancies in case of...
That's a special election? Well, there's a provision on it. It's 29.23.180, page 25. Vacancy in the office of chairman...
Filled by assembly.
Filled by assembly.
Until
next election. If assemblyman is chosen, he resigns his assembly seat. If the vacancy is more than 6 months before a regular election, assembly calls a special to fill the unexpired term.
Okay. I don't think we'd have any problem as long as we define what temporary is in this case.
The argument I would use to counter what you said about they're both elected officials is that there is a matter of the integrity of the legislative and the integrity of the executive.
I understand.
Do you have some other comments?
Just a couple more. Number of city council members. On page 25, lines 20 to 22, I think it says, I'm not quite sure of the figure, 6 councilmen for first class and 7 for... That doesn't make much sense to me. It should be the other way around. And secondly, I would suggest that it should not be necessarily limited to 6 and 7.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the six in a first-class city does not include the mayor.
Does not include the mayor. The seven in a first-class city does. In other words, the mayor of a first-class city is not a member of the council in a second-class city.
I see that. At this point, is why should you put it by statute? It's like an elector under your local option.
How are they going to decide to start one?
Well, they probably would offer.
As a practical matter, how many first-class cities will be in this state? How many are already home rule? Anybody know? Can somebody check that one out? Did you, Terry, find out how many first-class cities are affected by this code? Most cities are now home rule, aren't they, Don?
If you don't have some provision, for dealing with smaller cities or not, the jackpots are very small. They'll never do it themselves.
This copies the present law in part, I believe, as to the numbers.
I just have a couple of other items. Costs of election appeals. This carries over existing practice. That is, the person who challenges an election or recount must pay if he loses. I think that forces gambling. On the resolution of an issue which was in the public interest to resolve. And although you do want to discourage people from doing this frivolously, I think one way of getting at this is to, instead of putting the burden of pain on the guy who loses in a recount, say that if there's a difference of 1 or 2%, that the city will pay.
That's what state law is.
Because it's in the public interest to resolve a dispute like that, and it shouldn't be up to a guy's wherewithal or gambling instinct to resolve an issue in the public interest.
I agree.
What
state law is 0.1%, but I think that's too narrow because the spread, a 1% difference in a small vote base is a lot different than a 0.5% in a large vote base, and you might say 1 or 2%.
What? We can make a decision on this. It seems pretty non-controversial.
I'll move a 2% figure.
2%? Okay, that's the
that's
one.
Not, that's not very much,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to move to that as an amendment?
Yeah.
We can get this out of the way. Okay. Do I hear objection? I'm adopted.
Okay, similar sort of deal here. Maybe this. The code adds something new, and that is the requirement for a 2/3 majority in recall elections. Previously, it was a simple majority. I'm wondering what the rationale, I can guess what the rationale for that is, but I don't agree with it.
I think we changed that back in the Senate, didn't we?
Let's
see. Didn't we, Cliff?
I don't remember.
You don't have the page, Mr. Morehouse.
That's on page 42, lines 25 and 26, I believe. And that's on page 42.
No, we didn't then. We should have.
It may be in one of the supplements, though. I don't recall it's being amended, Mr. Chairman.
But, what's wrong with the 2/3?
Well, I'm saying that if a simple majority isn't considered a frivolous majority in the initial election, it shouldn't be considered frivolous in a subsequent recall. Further, in a recall, you're asked to have more turnout with more informed voters than you are in the initial election in the first place.
You veto the minority.
Not only that, it's damn difficult to even get a recall thing on the ballot.
That's right. It's difficult to
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move on page 42, line 25, the 2/3 be stricter, so that it would read a majority vote on the questions required to recall an office.
Do I hear
a
objection? No. Hearing none, so
that's all I have.
Now, Mr. Chairman, may I?
You bet.
Mr. Morehouse, I've been carrying your books and articles around in my briefcase for years to read on airplanes, and I read a couple of them occasionally, and I know you're very good in this field.
You fly more often than that.
But, and Mr. Fisher, of course, was one of the architects of Article 9 of the 9 or 10 of the state constitution. But in the years that I've been involved in local government, I have this terrible feeling that the thing isn't working in Alaska. Well, maybe Juneau and Sitka have now moved forward. But if you had to cite a couple of reasons why you don't think it's working, what would they be?
Well, here certainly is where Vic and I sometimes, I think, part company. Maybe I shouldn't preface that. I think that Article 10 is much, much too ambiguous, but that wouldn't have been a great problem if the intentions were clearer. And secondly, the legislation which implemented Article 10 remained ambiguous in part and very ad hocish in part. And so you've got a mixed approach, which didn't really maximize these grand ideals of Article 10. I think that when the first borough laws were passed in 61,
that they were done for very specific ad hocish reasons and not in the light of a rational overall plan for local government in Alaska, which supposedly Article 10 was to provide. And to go into the history of this, I think you know it.
Well, tell me this, insofar as the provisions of Article 10, in particular, in my own experience, I know that Sig is here from the Local Boundary Commission, but I'm sure that he'll, for local affairs, what failures do you view in that arena, in the Local Boundary Commission arena, if any? The Local Boundary Commission, as the Constitution is written, you know, it purports to set up some standards under which, well, for example, a provision in the Constitution says that no services will be provided by another government, you know, if they can be provided by the first government. There really hasn't been any enforcement of those concepts, has there?
I think the problem is it's a basic political problem. The Local Boundary Commission, it was assumed, would exercise political discretion that the legislature in the first instance should have exercised. In other words, there is an end run here, I think, around the legislative process. Assuming that a local boundary commission appointed by the governor will stick out its neck and have the political clout to make decisions that the legislature in the first place wasn't able or willing or by default didn't deal with through law. And I think that this accounts in part for the reluctance of the local boundary commission to get embroiled in some of the issues, although lately they've been acting more in accordance, I think, with some of the initial intentions.
I can see they've improved in the last year. Do you visualize any other major problems that the legislature ought to be dealing with in the area of local government? I recognize we can pass the municipal code, but I mean, from an overview standpoint?
I think that the options have been limited in the state of since enactment of the Bureau of Office.
Oh, we can change the Bureau of Office.
But that basically there's a political momentum that builds up. I mean, it's certainly clear in Anchorage that there are vested interests in the status quo, as well as conflict over how that status quo should be changed. And I think it's a little bit late in the game for the legislature, as a state legislative body, to attempt to insert itself into that kind of conflict and resolve it through state legislation. I think that we're working with a vehicle, or within limits, that we now have to work with them to make the best of. I'm not saying that they're necessarily bad, because this business of local government structure and political process is no cut and dry under no formulas. And I'm not necessarily saying that what the state is working with now isn't workable. But we do know that it's been very rocky, and a lot of conflicts have resulted from the existing structure of things. I can't stand back and say, well, there here is a route to deal with the basic problems of local government in Alaska, because I don't think such a route exists. I think it's working with what you have, as reflected in the proposed code and some of the revisions you've been talking about, and some of the things you're delaying for future sessions. That's the way in which I think you're going to be dealing with this problem. I don't see any alternative.
Okay, that's all I want.
Before he leaves, I know we're past 9:30, but one of the things that concerns some of us is the opportunity to shorten this bill, even in this late stage. It's a purpose material that drafting committee and, of course, our subcommittee working this. Is there any possibility that you could address yourself to that proposition without in any way changing the substance? I'm sure the rest of the committee would appreciate your looking into that matter, because it's an awful lengthy document, and maybe we can shorten it. Superfluous areas that could be combined.
Mm-hmm.
For one, I certainly appreciate your testimony, and I think it's very helpful.
Yeah, extremely helpful. We do appreciate it. In line with whatever you're saying, you're right, it is a big document. However, in my mind, I thought that maybe this is something that's going to have to be accomplished by another legislature, taking a look at it at another time, and getting it on the books. And then it can be relatively easily convinced. A lot of this stuff looks easy to convince, and then all of a sudden you get into it and find out that this provision looks like a good position, but it really isn't quite, so you have to leave them both in. At least that's been my limited experience, I think.
I presume don't take those factors into consideration.
Do we have any more questions? Anybody in the audience? We're operating on a pretty informal basis here. I don't want to hold back any questions. Well, Tom, I really do appreciate you coming down, and the information you've given has been very helpful. And as you can see, we've already adopted some of the suggestions already, and we're certainly looking into a great many others. And if you have any additional thoughts you want to put in writing within the next week or so, send them down for a page. We're not going to meet Thursday because the legislature has another function Thursday night.
How long are you going to be here? How long are you
planning on staying? I'll be here until Thursday.
Okay, but I'll give you any additional questions, maybe.
Bye. Maybe even come up with something you couldn't have done now. Just to take advantage of this person.
I gather there was a conflict. I mentioned earlier.
Well, we don't have to all meet, I think.
Well, what I'd like to have a chance to do is think further about it. And if there are areas that I feel I might have some suggestions to do that, but I feel like it's fairly well covered, but I think I'm just
which would work. Greg has been spent years on this, invaluable to the subcommittee. Free conference on the team. Two of you.
Well, if there's no more.